Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I had Dale White, head coach of the Erie Commodores, on the podcast. For those of you who've been listening to the show since its inception, you might remember episode 14, where I had Max and Arthur, two semi-professional European soccer players who play over in the minor league systems in the United States, on the podcast. We talked a lot about what it's like to transition from Europe to the United States, what the American soccer game is like from a player's perspective, and I had their coach, Dale, on the show to talk about what it's like from a coach's perspective and the state of the beautiful game in the United States of America and much more. I think even if soccer is maybe not your favorite sport, I still think that this is going to be a pretty enlightening and interesting episode for most of you. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can always leave a rating and review on iTunes. You can also support the show by subscribing on Patreon for $5 a month to get bonus episodes of the show, and just kind of helps support us out here. And of course, we are also sponsored by DailyRoto.com, the best projections and lineup tools in the industry. You can get 10% off of their elite package using the promo code Rory. You can also get access to the Roto Experts NFL 365 package, which is headed up by yours truly, using the promo code Matic on RotoExperts.com. Now let's get into the show. All right, everyone, would like to welcome to the show head coach of the Erie Commodores, Dale White. We actually had two of Dale's players on the show earlier on this podcast. I believe it was episode 13. But I got an email from the Erie Commodores organization, and Dale, really glad and really excited to talk to you about some soccer, about some footy today. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, really appreciate the time. I don't get to talk about soccer too often on this show, but it is the sport that I personally am most passionate about. So I'm really interested. What is your story of discovering not only soccer, not only football, but when you realized that you really loved it and that you wanted to pursue it as, you know, your profession?
Yeah, well, obviously, growing up where I did, it's an obsession over there. So, you know, every kid's kind of dream, or most kids' dream, is to play professionally. And as a child growing up, we used to play before school, during all three breaks at school and after school. I mean, it was really a lot, you know. But my first memory, I was thinking about this. My first memory was of my dad. In my mind, he'd kicked the ball up into the clouds one day when him and I were playing soccer. So I must have been really young then. Probably been playing since I could walk, if I'm honest.
What team did you root for growing up? Well, I guess what part of the United Kingdom are you from?
Well, I'm originally from Scotland, but I grew up most of my life in the north of England. My family mainly are from Glasgow, and obviously in Glasgow there are two teams built around the Catholic and the Protestant Church, and Celtic is the team that the Irish immigrants started through the Catholic Church, and Rangers is the team that the Protestant Church started. And you know, it's in history, it's been a bit of rivalry. Most of the problems are now somewhat under control, and it makes for a good atmosphere. Growing up, I followed the Celtic, but ironically, my dad is a Rangers fan, and that doesn't happen too much.
No, that would be like for people in the States, that would be like your dad being a Mets fan. Well, I guess it'd be your dad being a Mets fan and you being a Yankees fan, and Rangers have had a really hard time. They like went into default and had to restart over because the ownership went broke, right?
That's right. Yeah, there was some not so good business dealings, and then they've restarted, and you know, the football in that country is better off for the rivalry, so it's good that they're back up there. But I'm glad that Celtic's on top. That's them just won their eighth league in a row, so
Yeah, it's Celtic. They're the Golden State Warriors of the Scottish Premiership. When is the last time that Celtic didn't win the Scottish League?
Well, it's 8 years in a row now they've won it. So whatever that is, 2009, 2010 would be the last time, I think.
Yeah. So did you play like semi-professionally? Were you in any of the academies? Did you train with any of the teams while you were over there? Because if I remember from talking to Arthur, and I'm forgetting the name of your other player that I had on, they basically started playing in sort of a semi-professional structure really early. Was that your same experience, or did you kind of miss out on that because the structure didn't exist yet?
Well, it certainly was different, but where we lived, our nearest professional team was Carlisle, which was about 20 miles for us. So it was, and believe it or not, that was actually tough getting back and forward there. So I wasn't really in that setup for long at all. But when I was young, as a 14-year-old, I did captain a side, a representative side that had Rory Delap in it, who you may remember played for Stoke City in Ireland. He was the guy with the really long throw that would play for Stoke City. And then, you know, there were Paul Murray and Richard Procas. These guys all played professionally all of their life. They were in that team, but unfortunately I had to take a year out almost immediately after that, when I was 14, and then with back problems, and same thing again when I was 17. So it was really two pivotal times that really made things difficult for me. I did play in like the seventh tier in England a little bit, and then realized that my best option was to come out to the US and get my degree, because traditionally where I grew up, people either are educational or they're football, you know. So being able to combine the two was really good. It's been incredible out here.
So at what time period did you come over to the States? Were you 18, or were you a little bit older than that?
I was a little bit older. So I was 22, I believe, when I came here. And I'd already done 2 years of college at home, and then did 2 years of college here. So yeah, I was a little bit older than your regular freshman, you know, but it was still an exceptional experience for me.
So did you play soccer when you came over? Were you playing for the college team that you went on, or were you sort of right into the coaching when you came over here?
No, I came to play. Yeah, I came and I played for Gannon, where I'm coaching at college now, at Gannon University here in Erie. And The local college coach and a good friend of mine, Gary Cagiavis, he approached me while I was playing about coaching a couple of nights a week for a team that he had. And that was how the coaching started, really. He just took it as a part-time job and enjoyed it, but never ever thought about doing it beyond that. Probably wasn't until I was 25, 26, and I went back to England and was training in the seventh tier again. And, you know, I could see that it was going to take a long time for my face to fit in that team, which you're always dealing with when you're at that sort of level, you know, where there's many, many okay players. I mean, some not so good, but their face fits and they've been there for a long time, you know. So there was a lot of dynamics in trying to progress as a player. And that was when I first thought, well, maybe I should focus more on coaching. But then I came back to the U.S. again after I graduated college. And then I was with a team called the South Jersey Barons at the time in the PDL. And it was a similar story for me with injuries. You know, I just couldn't get going. And I think I'd been offered a place coaching at Mercyhurst University, again here in Erie, and I just suddenly thought, you know, well, that's a great way to make a living. I'm a frustrated player because I can't reach the heights that I want. And, you know, what an opportunity to start coaching as a job. So that was it. And then since then, I've just focused on that and focused on, you know, trying to really help players become better players and develop. And obviously my tactical understanding of the game and everything's grown as I've done that. So it's been good.
What position did you play while you were still trying to make that dream happen?
Yeah, well, as a youngster, I played in a sort of wider position on the right, usually. And then when I came to the US, I went more to a central position, which I think suits me. But when you're the young guy on the team at home, then, you know, you get pushed into those wider positions where you have to be more mobile and do a lot more, not necessarily more running, but in those days it certainly was. The wide wingers were doubling up as fullbacks and then getting into the corners and crossing balls. So, but I think once I moved to the US and was put into the center, that actually helped me a lot. It helped me. It suited more my way of playing, and then it also helped me understand the game on a much different level than I had up to that point.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a big difference between playing wide and playing centrally. So something that I'm always curious about is really Europeans and specifically English people, I always feel, have a really interesting perspective on how the game of soccer should be played. You know, Americans, we play really direct. So, you know, in the MLS, a lot of the football is really direct, especially when the teams have American managers. And actually think that style does sort of translate from English football, but there's a lot less crossing in the American game. Even if you watch the U.S. men's national team, they play pretty direct, but they do it through the middle. Whereas English football is a lot of wide play, a lot of crossing. You know, the tallest guy is the striker on a lot of, you know, the championship, League One, League Two teams. So kind of what is your approach to the game of soccer? You know, how would your perfect, most talented team play the game?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've got quite a balanced approach to it, to be honest. You know, I've got the game kind of pinned down to 9 sort of areas that we try to work on and focus on, and you know, those areas kind of touch on all the facets of the game. So I certainly try to have a complete sort of approach to it, as opposed to honing in on one area too much. But of course, as a coach, it's easier to implement things defensively than it is attacking, because obviously attacking requires a bit more spontaneity and a bit more creativity, if you like, not to devalue the defending at all. It's a different set of skills. But, you know, so I do tend to focus first and foremost on the defensive and where we defend, how we defend, you know, how we'll pressure the ball, when we'll pressure the ball, who will pressure on the ball. Those are kind of the ways that we set the teams up. You know, but I certainly like to play through the middle, only because I think that helps create space out wide. And obviously, if you can keep playing through the middle, that's great. But if you make 4, 5, 6 passes in the center of the field, then those wide players, those wide defenders tend to squeeze inside a little bit, which then leaves the outside space open. But yeah, I do understand completely what you're saying about the difference in the culture, if you like. Now, you know, it's fast and physical and furious when you think about it in England, but you got to realize that most of the time they're playing in, like, they're playing in 36, 37 degrees weather, so they're right. They're running over there just to keep warm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is really true. Also, you touched on something that I really wanted to talk about, which I think that coaching soccer is a lot different than coaching the major American sports, football and basketball. Because when we think about coaching football and basketball, we think a lot about how teams score And so for football, you know, you're diagramming plays out. And in basketball, you're diagramming sets and you set up the offensive responsibility. But it's just so hard to actually score in soccer. Like it is just an actual accomplishment every time that a goal gets scored. I feel like coaching offensive soccer, I honestly feel like it has to be one of the most difficult jobs in sports because it generally is such a spontaneous thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is difficult, and you know there's a lot more flow to the game of soccer than there is to any American sport, really. You know, or to any of the traditional American sports, I should say. And I think that it is a problem over here, which I think hinders the development a little bit. You know, because if you control things too much, you kill the organic sort of development, if you like, and the organic sort of coming together of the team and the players understanding each other. You know, and even in the college game where there's like this rule where you can substitute players on and off, it just breaks the game up and it puts more emphasis on fast and furious than it does on actually tactical understanding and sort of the creativity and the togetherness that we're talking about. So I do think that's a hindrance for the US in that respect. And I mean the ebbs and flows of the game and understanding them is a big part to being a coach, you know, but the NPSL, the summer teams, they obviously play in the FIFA structure, which means that, you know, they're only allocated so many substitutes. The college game's not recognized by FIFA, and therefore they can, you know, set their own rules. And as great a competition and excitement that it generates, I think purely for the development alone, somebody should look at lining that up the best they can with FIFA rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. So what do you view your role with the Erie Commodores is? How would you really define your job as a coach?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, obviously you're the first and foremost. You set the direction and then you've got to steer the ship. You know, so it takes time for the team to gel, and the season's obviously very short. Because it's predominantly college players playing over the summer, and as good as the level is, you know, it's a short season with maybe 16, 17 games. So there's not really too much time for them to maximize who they are as a team. You know, so again, it's about organizing, and if I can help each one of those players, which you hope that you can, given the amount of time you're focused on the game, if I can help each of those players tune their game and become a little bit more defined about who they are as a player and their strengths and limitations, then, you know, I would see that as my job done. Obviously, we've got team goals on top of that. You know, we won the league last year and we'd like to do that again. We've got the US Open Cup this evening, and if we win that game, we get to host the Pittsburgh Riverhand the following week, which, you know, I mean, those are bonuses, just because the Riverhands, they've been training since the beginning of February and we've been together for a few days now. So it's, you know, it's not realistic in terms of winning games like that, but it's just an excellent opportunity for the guys to go toe-to-toe with teams that are at the next sort of one step up, if you like.
Do you think that promotion and relegation will ever come to the American game? Do you think that it's even possible with the structures that they have in place?
I certainly hope so, because it changes the whole dynamic, Dave, of everything. I don't know. I know how America's set up, and you know the difference, the major difference between the European or the rest of the world, I should say, apart from a few countries, is that those clubs are all privately owned. You know, they've all been born out of the community and grown organically, if you like, and and America's trying to emulate that in many ways. But their structure is different because it's the clubs are owned by the MLS. It's a franchise that's sold to the business people, and there's an element of control which maybe takes away from certain aspects of the football culture in other countries. But if they were to add the promotion and relegation, you would see the whole sort of dynamics of the league. All of a sudden, teams that are three quarters of the way through the season and have got no chance of making the playoffs, but it matters that they keep going to get themselves out of their relegation. Obviously, then they're picking up points against the top team. It just makes for a different atmosphere. But obviously, the U.S. has a complete different sort of geographical layout. It makes it really difficult to, compare it to those European countries, which are often very small. I think England's about the size of Pennsylvania and has 96 professional teams. So you just can't emulate that in any way. So I'm not saying that I know that it would be better for the country, but I do know it would change the dynamics, and I certainly hope that FIFA steps in at some point. I have heard some people saying that FIFA are stepping into countries like the US and Australia and saying, okay, how can we do this promotion relegation? But obviously you've got all sorts of issues. You have in America, you have teams like Chattanooga that were playing in the NPSL level and pulling in 12,000 fans. Then you've got teams like the Pittsburgh Riverhounds who are in the USL, maybe pulling in 3,000. So it would be really difficult, because if you turn that the other way around, a team like Erie Commodores that maybe pulls in 400 fans, if we were to get promoted to another league, then how do we make our facilities compliant with hosting bigger teams? So there'd be a lot to think about. I certainly think somebody should take it on, certainly with the amount of money that's invested in sports in the US and the kind of place that it has in the culture. I think that somebody should be looking at that.
I think the biggest thing that promotion and relegation would change would actually be at your level and would be at the USL level, because in England, third-tier teams can be big multi-million dollar businesses. Sunderland is in the third tier right now, and they have facilities, they have a youth team, that Sunderland is a multi-million dollar business, and so are a lot of those other third and fourth tier teams, and they can afford to train players. And what happens in the United States with young players is they train out on like a national level or with like a traveling team that's sort of like its own business but doesn't play in a league. And I actually think promotion relegation would make the training for young American players way more standardized and would make the U.S. men's national team much better.
I think it's a fair argument. I do, and you're saying there about the youth players there, they're playing in kind of private club scenarios, settings where they're having to pay a lot of money to do that. And maybe by these smaller clubs getting a sniff of some of the dollars at a higher level would make them invest more in their youth, if you see what I mean, so that they can build these teams in the future. If the prize is that you can work your way up to an MLS status, then you're going to invest more in your youth programs. At the moment, the youth programs seem to serve as a moneymaker for families that are paying hundreds of dollars a month just to put on the shirt and play. If you were to see a promotion and relegation, you may have areas like Erie, for example, who has about 200,000 people in the surrounding area. Maybe somebody would invest in building a team over years, which might mean that America would then attract the better athletes into this scenario. At the moment, from what I see, they attract the athletes that can afford it, if that makes sense. You know, it's very much a middle class sport here. So yeah, you may be right. You add in that dynamic, it might change the whole sort of development. It might make players much more realistic and in terms of you know, much more having an impact on the game. Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see, but it would probably take 10 years for us to even see what happens once they put that in place.
Well, that is, you really did hit on the biggest problem with soccer in the United States, which is that it's really only available to be played by such a small number of people. You know, all the great American soccer players that you think about, you know, Pulisic and Landon Donovan and Alexi Lalas, these guys who went over to go play in Europe, DeAndre Yedlin, these guys had really unique advantages from a really young age, because they were, you know, they were put in financial circumstances where their parents could afford for them to be trained and to travel. And, you know, that doesn't exist with basketball or football. You know, it really, anyone can play those sports in the United States, just the way that it's structured with the world set up. And I don't know if I have a solution to that problem right now, but I do think that putting some of the burden on the training away from the parents paying for it to these league teams is one of the possible solutions.
I think you're right, and you're saying that the promotion and relegation, you're going to find local businessmen would jump on board here, because they would see the opportunity. That back in Europe, mainly the investors are working class people that built businesses and made money and understand the football's role in their people, if that makes sense. You know, so they're the types of people that invest in the teams there, which then means there's money to develop the youth players, which then means that they're scouring the local projects, if you like, for those tough, hard-nosed, blue-collar, working-class guys that will, you know, that have not many other options. You know, I mean, I know a few friends of mine always joke that if Wayne Rooney hadn't been a footballer, they'd been stealing car radios. So, you know, these kids have got everything invested in this. The best way to do that, develop the best athletes, is have businessmen that can see the opportunity in that and then invest the money at the grassroots within the club, and then build a success through that. But, you know, and then that way it's easing the burden on the parents and the families, and obviously the ones that can afford it. It's great, it's worth it. They know that their children are getting so much out of the quality coaching, because that is the benefit of the private club setting. You know, the club here in Erie, Mill Creek Soccer Academy, the number of quality coaches that are in that club because of the investment of the parents is exceptional. That every year, every team, we're turning away 2, 3, 4 great players because they can't afford it. We can't find a sponsor. We have one now on my U17s team. He's a 15-year-old boy that I spotted and said, you know, you have to come and play for us. And they came and played for a month, 2 months, and the parents just couldn't do it. You know, they tried. They just couldn't pay the money, and you know, so the benefit is the type of coaching they get, the influence that the kids are getting in that environment, and the professionalism of the club that it is set up. The flip side is those kids that fall through the cracks that we're talking about here. And you know, if there was just some sort of initiative where local businessmen got involved and 3 or 4 players from each age group in a community to make a difference, you know.
So something I did want to get into the weeds with a little bit was I wanted to talk about how you set up the tactics for the Commodores, like sort of first of all, what formation do you guys run generally, or how often do you switch formation?
Yeah, so we'll probably start with a 4-2-3-1, which is my kind of preferred default, and that's only because we literally haven't had enough time to build the formation around the players, which you have to do. I mean, any coach that's telling you this is the way we play might be a little bit short-sighted. You have to build your formation around your team, around your strengths. There's simply no other way to do it, So, yeah, we're focusing at the moment on a 4-2-3-1, and that could change very easily. And bearing in mind that formations are, often overemphasized over the ability and the personnel that you've got in there and how they play. I don't think I've ever told the team that's what we play. I just put the players in and when we put it on the board, that's kind of what it resembles. But I mean, and actually talking to the team and saying today we're going to play a 4-2-3-1, it's not really how you do it, if that makes sense. And I mean, even at home, people have an over sort of obsession on that. And certainly in America, where, like you said, you're coming from backgrounds of like basketball and football, where it is very much about how you set everything up. So we'll be much more likely to find which players we can't afford to have in there. And if that means we play with two guys on the right and no guy on the left, we'll do it. If it means, it's the other way around, we'll do it. The reality is once you get the right people on the pitch and you get them working together, that's what breeds the success, not whether it's a 4-4-2 or a 4-5-1 or 3-5-2. So
what is it like to set up a team tactically, or is it about, so you tell the defensive midfielders, okay, this is your role, I need you to mark this guy, I need you to not go past here, is the striker given, a lot of freedom, or the attacking midfielder given a lot of freedom? Sort of, what is it like in terms of like individual instructions for all the players to really set up a team's tactics for a given game or for a season?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. You're just putting certain limitations on them. We tend to follow a rule of thumb that we keep five behind the ball and five in front of the ball. Obviously, that doesn't ring true every time. And then it's about balance. If we're attacking there, then we've got to keep the balance there and vice versa. We'd never limit anybody from not going beyond the line, if you like. But if they do, someone else has got to understand that they've stepped up and that they've got to maybe create some space by dropping off. So again, it's really this sort of interchange of understanding between each other. The success is really determined by how well they link up with the players around them. But the forwards, we tend to try and keep one player between the goalposts at all times. And obviously, 90% of the time, that's a forward. And those times when he drifts out of position, a midfielder will fill that role. And then just determining your style of play, whether you play close and compact the middle, whether you're stretched out. These are the things to think about. And again, we're like trying to develop a complete team. It's just the same sense when you're working with the players. You're trying to develop them to be complete players and not be rigid and limited by the tactical implementations, if that makes sense. Obviously, half of it is, or one side of it is tactics. It has to be. And then one side of it is how the players play in that tactical setup, if you like.
So sort of along with that tactics discussion, something I've literally always wondered this about soccer, it's how difficult it might be for a guy to change position, because really a lot of the times, you'll see center backs score goals, you'll see strikers back in the box defending. There, really as most positions, you're required to do a little bit of everything, passing, defending, shooting, all of it. And the example that's always come to my mind was Danny Welbeck, because he played for Arsenal, and he was always, you know, a striker. Maybe sometimes he would play out on the left. But for as long as I can remember, Arsenal has always needed a sort of good, active, central defensive midfielder, and Welbeck was always a good defender for a striker. So as a coach, would it even be possible to change him positions? Would that just, you know, be a waste of his talents in front of the goal? Like, is it possible for the guys like that to switch roles?
Yeah, I mean, you do tend to see it a lot, you know. I think Ryan Giggs, they moved him into more central role. I think David Beckham played a little bit more in the center, although, I mean, he was an out-and-out, you know, cross out of the ball, so it certainly didn't suit him perhaps as well. But yeah, as players get older, they tend to move them back and into where they can maybe have more of an influence on the build up of the play. Lothar Matthäus for Germany and Bayern Munich, he was a good example. He moved back a lot. I'm not sure that Danny Welbeck would be the type to play in the centre. You know, I think his attributes are definitely his mobility, his long stride. But yeah, as a sort of rule of thumb, players do tend to change positions a little bit from as they get older, from a more mobile role to someone that's maybe a bit more static, a bit more structured.
Yeah, you do definitely see that. Like Wayne Rooney, yeah, at the end of his time in England, he was like, there was a couple times Rooney for Everton played like basically defensive midfielder. He was behind Gylfi, yep, Sigurdsson and paired with Davies, right, or Idrissa Gueye.
Yep, and that tends to be, you know, that sort of holding midfielder role tends to be an easier one for somebody that's 32, 34. Than a young 21, 22-year-old. Obviously, there are exceptions. That's, you know, you've got the boy Winks at Tottenham, who's a young guy with an incredibly high pass success ratio, playing in a withdrawn midfield position. But yeah, I mean, that's a great example. Wayne Rooney dropping in there because he can have an influence on the game. You know, he understands the movement and where players will be. So I think that's a much better sort of example of that than what Danny Welbeck might be.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that you also had Valencia at Man United. Remember, they dropped him back to fullback where he played for probably 6 years, and before that he was an out and out winger. I mean, that's probably a fairly interchangeable position, but you know, once he dropped him back to fullback, I don't think he played higher up the field anymore after that.
No, he did pretty, like, that is a pretty common one. You'll see where when wingers get a little bit older, they'll move back. You know, Jordi Alba was a winger when he was young, actually, yep, for Man United as well. Ashley Young has played a bunch of different positions. He's played central midfield. Yes. He's played left back, right back. Fabian, yep, Del for Manchester City. And that's a pretty interesting thing in general. You know, you're right, Americans do get hung up on these positions, but sometimes in the course of a team, you can play, you know, a different position on offense and on defense. You know, the Pep's fullbacks, yes, play central midfield on offense, and then they come back and they play wide defender.
Yep. Yeah. So that's a pretty standard evolution, if you like, from there to there, yeah. But that's an interesting one about Ashley Young. Just going back to the point we were making earlier, Ashley Young, when he was developing, he was not going to be offered a professional contract. You know, they were releasing him. You know, obviously each team has 18 to 20 kids playing at home, and they know from quite early which ones they think are going to make it and which ones don't. You know, obviously they need a full team to do that. But when he was at Watford, I believe it was, they weren't going to keep him on. And there was a couple of people that really vouched for him, and they actually found someone to sponsor him at £50 a week for his first contract. And, you know, now look at him. I think he certainly wore the armband at Manchester United. I think he may have even worn it at England at a point. But, you know, that's a perfect example of somebody that just never would have had the chance had somebody not been investing money to give kids a chance to play.
I mean, and there are a lot of stories like that. Jamie Vardy was playing in, you know, the non-professional leagues before he latched on with Leicester. The Brighton striker, Glenn Murray, who he was maybe even going to get invited to the World Cup with England this last time. He was in the United States, actually. He played for the Wilmington Hammerheads or something like that, and then ended up back playing for Brighton. So there are definitely more opportunities like that in the English game, whereas, you know, that guy would end up selling insurance if he stayed in the United States.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. That's it. It's a hard thing to change. It really is, but you know, hopefully over time they can do it, because it's incredible here, and I think you'll see. You know, I always said that you would see the national team here keep developing. When I first came here, I used to go back and say, like, you're going to see this country blossom as a football nation. It's really taken off, and then it seems to take off, and then not go anywhere from there. But now I think it's fair to say that it's really taken off, that it's now, you know, you're seeing all these towns, smaller towns with teams in this sort of NPSL league and the formerly the PDL league. And, you know, you're seeing fans that, obviously with the globalization of everything, you're able to have pretty decent conversations about football, and like you're saying, the understanding of it, which you weren't seeing before. And I think that's a great sign that it is actually really taking a hold here. You know, but it has to make its impact on the top three or four traditionally American sports to try and get some of those better athletes. And if it can do that, I mean, it's a different ball game for them altogether as a national team. So hopefully that's what we'll see anyway.
Well, American interest in the top leagues in Europe has, like, never been higher. Like, the Champions League is, like, people know about the results of Champions League games now, where, like, you know, 10 years ago when I was in high school, I don't know if people could have even, like, I don't even know if people in that I would have, like, went to high school with, I don't even know if they would have known who Lionel Messi is. And now people are, you know, if I wanted to go watch a Fiorentina game on a Thursday afternoon, I'd be able to find it on TV somewhere.
Exactly. And I think, you know, when I first came here, you're right, that the only games that were televised were the Champions League ones on ESPN. And that was it. You know, now you can actually get more access on TV to the games than you can in Europe. Europe, it's locked up even more than it is here with TV rights. And, you know, there are so many different companies selling the packages that it's hard to get as much as you do here. So it is. It's way ahead of where it was.
So, sort of as our last topic here, what do you think about the sort of the concerning nature of how much money is really in the top five teams? Real Madrid, Barcelona, PSG, Bayern Munich, and you know, Manchester City. Does all of this money funneling to the top sort of concern you about the future game of football?
I mean, if I'm thinking about it, just, you know, logically, yes, it is. I mean, logically, it just feels like the rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to get poorer. But there's always exceptions to the rules. I mean, just look at the Liverpool game yesterday. I mean, that's incredible feat by them, you know, and it's always 11 against 11. And it's, I know that sounds like a cliche, but it's, and obviously there's a lot more than just the 90 minutes of the game. It's the years of developing those players. But that the goal by Trent Alexander-Arnold, that when he set up Origi, the fourth goal for Liverpool against Barcelona yesterday, You saw 7, 8 Barcelona players switch off. You know, they're top professionals, probably the highest paid in the world. And they switch off to concede the fourth goal, to lose 4-0, to give up a 3-0 lead in the home leg. And, you know, they're still human beings. So, yes, the money does play a huge factor. Of course it does. But you can always develop people. You can always develop players. You can. It's the same skills that are required. You know, it's they're human beings, and you only last so long at the top, and unless the right leadership are coming in, and you know, and then what do you do when the team switches off like that? What does the manager do? Does he come in the changing room and tell him, you just probably cost me my job? Do the club back him, and then does he make some big decisions and cut some big players to keep everyone on their toes, or does he just try to keep the status quo so that he doesn't risk the fans turning against him? You know, there's so many more dynamics at the bigger teams that they don't have at the smaller teams. So, yeah, there's not always parity in terms of the money, but you'd always look at Leicester City a few years ago. You're always going to get those fairy tales. It's why it's so wonderful. It's why we do it. And, you know, it's there does need to be rules, as there are, and as will keep happening, that try to protect the integrity of the game, if you like. But, you know, it's hard to really say that the top five are going to lock it all up and that's it. You know, I think there's been some perfect examples of how there'll always be groups of people, there'll always be businessmen that want to invest in smaller teams because they can't get in the bigger teams that can, you know, throw the cat amongst the pigeons, so to speak.
There we go. Dale, thank you so much for the time. Do you have is there a way for people to watch the Commodores games if they wanted to?
Oh, there is. The tonight one is being streamed. I know that if you go to Erie Commodores on Facebook or Twitter, you'll find a stream for that. We're playing the Dayton Dutch Lions. Yeah. So the games are all streamed one way or another. Obviously, the people in Erie, oh, they can come on down to Gannon University and watch the game at 7 o'clock. But the streams are all there. ESPN is streaming the game tonight.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for the time.
Excellent. Thank you, Dave.